Well, good afternoon, wherever you may be. Welcome to Observations. I did not make our last show either on this afternoon for Observations or for Yada Ya. Kirk, you and Larry took over in the evening. My illness was actually fairly significant. I got a throat bacteria that caused infection. That caused my throat to swell to the point that I couldn't sleep for fear of not being able to breathe, of falling asleep and suffocating. And for Thursday night, Friday night, and most of Saturday, I couldn't talk. My throat was so sore and so raw. But my biggest issue was just complete, utter fatigue because I was literally afraid to fall asleep. Thinking that, you know, my throat it was so close to being swollen shut that I would suffocate. Oh, really? Well, yeah, strange
it's
feeling.
Tricky as in people when they get that bad, too.
Yeah.
Keep breathing. Yeah, absolutely.
God, my throat was so sore, I can't even imagine them putting in a tube.
Yeah.
that would have been like birthing a baby.
Mm. Mm.
So you all talked about Pesach Matzah B'Kurim. Interesting to figure out this year as to what time we're going to be celebrating Pesach. I have my conclusion, but there are really three very different options. I don't know if you've looked this year, but this year on March 28th, we have at the moon sets. At 6:24. So 6:24 is when the moon sets. These are all times in Jerusalem.
Mm-hmm.
Sunset is at 5:56. So the moon is going to set about 30 minutes after sunset on this day, and it's going to be half of 1% at that time is going to be visible. So it meets my criterion for observational in the very purest sense.
Mm-hmm.
But because the moon is setting after the sun, when the moon sets, it's going to have half of 1% of light on it.
That is
really slim pickings. In fact, that is so slim that I'm actually going to use the next day. I'm going to use Wednesday. As the day, that's just, you know, if it were a Yobel year, and we were dealing with one of the important years like year 2033, I would probably take that and say, well, that is precisely the definition that Yahweh has given us of Kadash, and mm-hmm. he's going to be precise, and he's obviously going to use astronomical because there will be no observational capability.
No,
in 2033,
mess the world's going to be in. No,
right. So, if it was 2033, I would go. I would probably go with Tuesday, but that's just too thin. So I'm going to happen to go with Wednesday, March 29th, as the day, which will put Pesach. And this is what's interesting: Pesach, if you were to go strictly astronomical, would start on Monday evening at sunset and be all day Tuesday. Until sunset, the 10th and the 11th. If you go observational, because you can't see one half of 1%, then it would be begin on Tuesday at sundown on April 11th and go all through the day on Wednesday, the 12th of April.
Mm-hmm.
That's the time that I'm going to celebrate Pesach. And we've talked about this before. I celebrate the beginning of Pesach as part of matzah. Because Yahweh instructs us to eat matzah on Pesach. So when he says,
right.
You shall eat matzah on yeasted bread for 7 days, well, since he's instructed us to eat unleavened bread, Pesach, or matzah on Pesach,
yeah.
I count that as one of the seven. And if you want to eat it 7 days in addition to the Pesach,
yeah.
which would be for 8 days,
yeah.
That's fine. I've got no issue whatsoever with those that do it. I find I'm not trying to cheat on the number of days here.
No.
I'm being precise, but I'm being precise for a particular reason, and that is that I've come to appreciate the enormous merit and making matzah and pesach coterminous.
Mm-hmm.
Because if pesach is not coterminous with matzah,
yeah, so
we're in a worse. It's the worst possible thing. It's immortality still. Expressly excluded from Yahweh. Well, there is a place to go, and it's just not a good.
You know what I mean? Nowhere to go is good.
Yeah, nowhere to go that's good. So anyway, I'm going to celebrate it Pesach this year based upon the observational dates. I think that makes the most sense. So it would be Wednesday, April 21st. It'd be the time. What's interesting though is Hebkow is presenting for 2017. Tuesday, April 11th. But Hebkow is presenting Sunday, April 9th. I don't get where they get that. But anyway, there, because that is clearly prior to a full day prior to the first renewed light. I don't know how they get that time, but anyway, those are the three days for Pesach. Sunset Monday, April 10th, sunset on Tuesday, April 11th, or you want to go Hebkow, which will be the Jewish religious celebration time, beginning Sunday, April 9th, going for a week in all three cases. One of the things I just wanted to share ever so briefly is that I guess that during the program on Friday evening, in talking about Pesach Matzah and Bukurim, Larry got into a brief depiction of the Yobel and talked a little bit about the nature of society today being socialistic. And I would like to just reemphasize what I think is Yahweh's economic plan. And this is what I wrote to the person who sent me a copy of an observation they made to Larry, thanking him for the program. I said, I sense by reading the explanation of the Yobel that Yahweh favors free enterprise. And that he values the work ethic. In fact, I don't think there's any question. I'm absolutely certain that Yahweh values the work ethic. And that he is a proponent of not only free will and free choice, but a free enterprise. He wants us to work and he wants us to be able to choose where and how we work. He doesn't want anyone controlled by government. So any fascist or communist scheme that is top down, or any socialist scheme that is collectivized as opposed to individual, would be in opposition to Yahweh's overall view of man's labors. So he is definitely free enterprise. He values the work ethic. He values individual accountability and family responsibility. There is, however, a communal aspect of his economic plan. Workers must be liberated within a maximum period of 50 years, and they can never be treated inappropriately. In fact, everyone is invited to become full members of the covenant, making everyone who makes that choice kin over time. This is a far cry from the Roman Catholic approach that dominated, oppressed Europe for over 1,000 years of lord and serf. It's exactly the opposite of that.
Right.
And it is even the opposite of this notion, you know, in a democracy, you have a tyranny of the majority over the minority.
Right.
And you really create an environment where it is impossible for the people to liberate themselves from the constraints that are imposed by government. And so there is no, you know, Jefferson wanted a revolution every 200 years. Well, that's, we've really made that impossible. In fact, I was having a conversation with my son, when we disagree fundamentally on all aspects of this about, you know, Trump care versus Obamacare. And what's really ailing America as it relates to its health care problem. And neither of those plans took into account any of the things that would actually drive down the cost of health care and make it more affordable. You know, for example, 90% or 80% of the health care costs in America is spent prolonging the life of the elderly 1 year. What an absolute waste of money. Complete waste of money. Shouldn't be done. Should eliminate it entirely. Go, if you're in the throes of death in your last year, use hospice to make the last year as painless and as enjoyable and as family-oriented as absolutely possible. They're marvelous. What a wonderful organization is hospice. And the next thing is that we don't deal with liability intelligently. We don't know how to put the negative consequences of providing medical care in relationship to what is the consequence if the care is not provided. So if 1% is harmed by a drug that serves 80%, the company providing that drug can be sued for billions of dollars, even though the overall drug is a tremendous benefit to society.
Yeah.
Now, that is a serious problem that that neither Obamacare nor Trump care deal with. Another is that medical care in America is very expensive because of the fact that it costs $1 billion often to bring a drug to market and a decade of time. Now, that process should be streamlined so that it's in the tens of millions of dollars to do the research, not a billion, and that the time from testing to making the drug available, at least on a limited basis, should be in 2 or 3 years, not a decade, would bring down the cost tremendously.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, the big issue with the runaway costs in healthcare is that since 1965, when Lyndon Johnson created the Great Society, government has gone from a non-player in healthcare
to the player,
controlling about 70% of the spending. And government doesn't do anything well. So those are the issues that we're not willing to do with the issue. But the reason we're not willing to deal with the issues is that America is no longer governed as a republic under the rule of law, which is how the only place where free enterprise can thrive is in a republic under the rule of law, or an oligarchy, where the only people that can vote are those that, A, have a vested interest in this society or net contributors to the society, and those who are educated enough to be able to make decisions on the issues. But in a pure democracy where anybody can vote, and therefore the majority can vote to take from the productive, your stuff away, you have no chance of having a sound economy or any kind of a nationalized healthcare program. It's impossible.
I believe it was described as two wolves and a lamb talking about what's for dinner.
That is correct. That is democracy. It's tyranny of the majority on the minority, and it has no chance of long-term success. And it's part of the reason we're in this problem, the collectivization of the society as opposed to individual responsibility and individual opportunity. So as I was saying this, so the first thing is that Yanawa makes it such that all workers, and from his point of view, we're all workers.
Mm-hmm.
He wants everyone to work. In fact, that was the consequence of Adam, for Adam, after he ate from the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. From that point on, you're going to need to work. Previously, I'd only given you information that was good. You didn't have to work. But now that you have both, you need to work at it. You got to work to know the right answer at this point. You need to work now to provide for your family. So But workers are all liberated at the absolute longest period of time that you could be unliberated is 50 years. 50 years is kind of interesting because, you know, we can become productive as individuals, earning a living sometime around 15 to 20 years old.
Yeah.
You know, normal time is around 20 that an individual becomes productive.
Well, normal time in United States concept, most of the world from your 15, 16 years old.
Yeah, most of the world, and certainly back, you know, because the Iowa's truth has to be true for all time, that, 12 to 15 at one time was the timing that it, you became productive. But let's just use 20 as a round number for today.
All right.
The number for retirement now, for most people, they just say, you know, at that point, I need to stop working at my, you know, it's time to give it up, is about 70. Mm-hmm. Now, it used to be 15 and 65.
Right.
But now it's 20 and 70. Oh, could you do the math and tell me what the age difference is between 15 and 65 or 20 and 70?
That's the same, isn't it? 15.
Mm-hmm. How many years is that?
Well, that would be 50 years.
Huh. And how long can a person can be before they must be liberated?
50 years.
Okay. Now, Yahweh used that same plan on debt and property, didn't he? 50 years. So
right.
That is the length of time that a lone individual, free enterprise, a lone individual can either be devoted to a particular job,
right,
or can be managing a piece of property, or can be loaning or borrowing money,
right,
for their for whatever it is that they're doing. 50 years. It's pretty sound, isn't it?
It seems to make sense, but
yeah. So the next thing is that Yahweh was pro-property, which means that communism is not a godly concept.
No.
Because you can own property in Yahweh's view of things. In fact, people absolutely own property.
Mm-hmm.
And also socialism and fascism, which are two sides, different sides of the same coin, where ownership is possible in socialism and in fascism, but the government has absolute control over what you can do with your property.
Yeah.
That is in opposition to Yahweh, because Yahweh tells you can do anything you want to your property.
Yeah.
Your property. Use it however you want. No restrictions, in fact, no taxation. No restrictions, no taxation.
It ain't yours.
Right. Do whatever you want, but at the end of 50 years, every 50 years, it must be surrendered back to the community. That was what caused so much, and has over time caused so much displacement between rich and poor, is the accumulation of property.
Mm-hmm.
Whether that property was real property in the terms of factories or businesses or land.
Right.
That ownership, the lords of Europe, they
right.
owned enormous tracts of property.
Absolutely.
And so Yahweh says, you know, you can do whatever you want to over your productive lifetime, but at the end of it, got to give it all back. It's communal property again. Anyway, I kind of like the idea. Well, I hate the idea of, you know, of being taxed while you're making a living and then having a death tax so that the government takes everything and your heirs get next to nothing. I do like the idea of limiting how much you can pass on via inheritance. And this, every 50 years, all debts have to be forgiven, all slaves have to be freed, all land is transferred. It precludes creating elite families, you know, wealthy families, royalty, that sort of thing.
Yeah, speaking of David Rockefeller, right?
Right, yeah, it becomes impossible to have a David Rockefeller kind of situation, a Kennedy situation. And that means that every individual has to start their lives essentially on their own.
Mm-hmm.
But they're not really starting on their own, because now what you're investing in your child is something vastly more valuable than money. What you're investing in your child is a knowledge of Yah, is an understanding of the covenant, of an appreciation for the Torah, of a love of knowledge and an appreciation for being judgmental, for exercising good judgment, of being thoughtful. If you can pass on those skills along with the proper perspective on family, on love, on what to hate and what to appreciate, then you've given them something vastly more valuable than money. Extraordinarily more valuable. And so that's Yah's approach. And if we were investing that in our sons and daughters, they'd be far wealthier. But far more importantly, they'd be far more likely to be part of the covenant and be vastly better people than if they inherited money. So the next thing is that Yahweh says that private banking, that's acceptable as well.
Sure.
That's got nothing.
I loan you some startup.
Right, right, exactly. So he says that while private banking is acceptable, as our interest on loans, all debts have to be forgiven over the same span of time, over the productive life of an individual. Now, 50 is also, it's not just the productive life of an individual. 50 is the basis of the Yobel, which is 7 sevens plus 1. And it, 7 is the answer to everything that Yah views as important. And so 7 sevens, Shabua, which is what the Yobel is based on.
Right.
That would be Shabuah, which is the time that Yahweh enables the most wonderful benefits of the covenant to be enriched and to be empowered for on behalf of his children. That Shabuah is the promise of seven. It's the promise of the Shabbat.
Mm-hmm.
And so the promise, the 7 sevens, is the promise of the of seven, of this formula that Yah has created by the one who created, on behalf of the one, and by the one who created this this plan. And so that's why it's 50. That's why it's 7 sevens plus 1. And it just happens to coincide by design with the productive work period of a human life.
Pretty amazing.
Yeah, it's pretty amazing. So, his plan, which is free enterprise based, but with these three essential elements, all people liberated, all land returned, and all debts forgiven every 50 years, gives everyone the opportunity to succeed.
Right.
But they're not entitled to success.
No.
It doesn't penalize success, and it doesn't reward failure. And it provides the greatest possible stimulus for economic success and growth, while at the same time preventing the accumulation of wealth among the few.
Mm-hmm. Which begs the question that I think if you viewed it that you have your opportunity to play and you're not building an empire, and you don't have those kind of thoughts, then you would probably go in. If my father told me, he said, son, whatever you do, you're going to work for about 60 hours a week. At least you're going to be thinking about it if you're not actually at the office or whatever. And it's going to be, so you better pick a job that you like and want to be involved with, because you have to spend an awful lot of time to provide an income for the family and so forth and so on. And,
yes.
And I was fortunate enough to be able to get good enough at something I love to do and to make a living at it.
Mm-hmm.
And most people should be in the right slot instead of looking off to build this empire or whatever they're doing. I mean, there's nothing wrong with that. That's your thing, to go build a big corporation that produces whatever. Go for it. But
yes,
in Yah's plan, he's more concerned about the individual, I think, that you succeed. And obviously, it's not something to hold over to keep perpetuating like the Rockefellers did and so
yeah.
forth. But it just leaves too much room for evil intent
right.
that way.
And do things in preparation for future yeah. success.
Sure.
You know, the more I study Yahweh's word, the more likely I am to make the right decision when confronted with an opportunity. You know, going back to healthcare for a moment, one of the problems that we have is that people think that they're entitled. So that if you're obese and you get diabetes and you are not paying for your health care, but a beneficiary, one of the 60 million people that between Medicare and Medicaid that rely on others to provide their health care for them. My view is if you're obese and you get diabetes, It should be other people's responsibility to resolve that problem for you. If you are obese, I mean, excuse me, if you smoke and you get cancer or heart disease,
right,
you should die. As opposed, unless you can pay, you know, if you've raised the money and you want to squander your own money because you were stupid, that's your call.
Right.
But you ought not be able to get other people to provide cancer treatment if you smoked. I'm sorry.
Well, it's not my responsibility if you become an alcoholic and you drink yourself to death. I can't,
right.
You know, that I can.
Right. I'm not going to give you a liver.
I can't make a life work out of it.
Exactly. Ought not be responsible for you if you chose to abuse drugs. I think you should be free to do so. But if you do so, you ought not be able to get society to pay for your
mistake.
Right. You know, and I also look at it, too, is that if, and this is the, one of the reasons that socialized medicine gives the appearance of working in other countries, they don't pay for the extraordinary.
Mm-hmm.
So, for example, if you're in Europe and you need a triple heart bypass, if you're on socialized medicine, you aren't getting it.
Mm-hmm.
Unless you can afford to pay for it and you fly to the United States, you aren't getting it. There have to be limits on what is provided on behalf of the indigent, of the poor. You know, I've got no issue with you break an arm, you break a leg, and you can't afford to have it fixed. By golly, let's fix it for you. You know, you get a...
No help, if you want to look at it that way. There's no help to a society that half of the people are hurt.
Right.
You know,
right.
Fix the leg.
Fix the leg.
Back into production.
Don't treat illness in a hospital. Go into a much more efficient means of distributing it. You know, I don't recommend this, but for the last 15 years, I have not had a doctor.
Mm-hmm.
What happens, and you know, people who have listened to this program know that I got bit by a brown recluse. They know that I got systemic poison ivy, and now you know that I had a very bad issue with my throat that with an infection.
Mm-hmm.
In each case, there is a really lowbrow. I mean, it's an ugly building that is really unappealing, the look of this place, but it's convenient. There's a prompt care facility that's a 5-minute drive from where I am right here. And 100% of the staff is women. All the doctors are women. All the nurses are women. All the reception people are women. And you go in there, and it costs $50. And you lay down your $50, and 5 minutes after you put down your $50, you're in with a nurse practitioner that is taking your vitals, asking your questions. And 5 minutes after that, a doctor comes in and asks you a few questions and says, you know, based upon what you've said here, I think the best course of action is this antibiotic, this steroid, this whatever, this injection. Let's go ahead and prescribe that. Here is your prescription. If this does not resolve the issue, you come back. For $50, 15 minutes of time.
Pretty good deal.
It's an efficient way of dealing with this without all the pomp and ceremony and cost. And that's part, I think, of what I was saying. Let's just be practical. You know, it's like in his economic plan, while there is no welfare, no taxation and no welfare,
mm-hmm.
If you are a farmer, you're asked to keep a small corner portion of what you have grown available to be harvested. So the person that's hungry has to go harvest it.
Mm-hmm.
They have to go prepare it. They have to go cook it. They have to go serve it to themselves and to their family.
Yeah.
But it's there
for the animals.
But yeah, for their animals. But it's there for them so they don't starve.
Right.
You know, wood would be provided, but no carpentry on it. You want to build a shelter out of. You need to wood for a fire. It's your responsibility to go get it and to make productive use of it. Wool, same thing. You weren't given clothes. You weren't given a credit card and food stamps to go. But wool was provided, and you could weave it into fabric and then sew it into a garment.
Mm-hmm.
That is the way we ought to be dealing with things. That's the way people ought to be responsible, to be accountable. to appreciate the value of work. All right, now you and Scott, not last week, but the previous week, where I was out of town, and I'm probably going to be out of town again next Friday. For those that don't know, my youngest son has now graduated with a PhD in medicinal chemistry from Baylor, and he has decided he's going to use that degree to be an intellectual property lawyer, which is someone who is involved in the medical research and development and drugs and therapies provided by scientists and through the medical community, the not only the patents on those, but the ability for companies to be able to market those and the defense of their work and their rights under, you know, you make a $1 billion investment, you really need to make certain that you're doing so in the proper manner. So he's going to be an IP attorney using his PhD. And there's a number of firms where half of the partners, half of the law partners have PhDs. So there are some firms that are really good in patent defense and prosecution litigation that this is something he's going to do. So he applied to a bunch of law schools. He was accepted at seven, and we are visiting now those seven schools. And, you know, I provide airlift as a pilot for him so we can go in and be efficient with our time. And I believe that next Friday and Saturday I'll be with him as I go again on last Wednesday I was with him. I'll be with him again on Monday of this week as we go to various law schools around the country, and he gets the opportunity to choose which one he wants to go to.
Okay. In light of that, let me ask you a question. If I can review a little bit today, but there's still a little bit of meat left on the bone. If you won't, if Scott agrees next Friday, perhaps we can finish off the third part of this. But there were some questions that arose from our discussion last week, and a couple of things that are quite interesting. So while we have a short period of time right now,
yeah, why don't we do that? Why don't
let me ask you? Let me do.
Yeah, why don't we do with those, and you and Scott
ask you some
will go
questions and see what your thoughts on.
Okay. Okay.
And Kirk, we can definitely do that next week, Kirk.
Okay, then let's do that right.
And then perfect. And then what we'll do is this,
understand what's going on.
This evening show, we're going to drill down deep on what it means, what Yahweh means by a Zion, and where Zion is located, and what are the key attributes of Zion as it relates to Yahweh and to Dod and to his home and to his family and the like. We have a lot to learn and consider relative to Zion. So we'll do that on tonight's show.
Yeah. Well, what we did do, and it presents a few questions, and then I have a couple more the stuff that I sent you, I think some of them are itemized on page 9 and 10. But what we did last week as a really brief review is we started out with the 10th plague. And what we found was that you're kind of confronted by a couple of things. You had some type of gigantic earthquake after all this other destruction that had taken place.
Mm-hmm.
And as a result of that, the temples fell, the palaces fell, all the stone work was really crushed. Egypt was pretty much destroyed. You had, at least we know for sure, that the Pharaoh's son was killed, because the poor also recorded that as well.
Yeah.
And by the way,
at this particular time,
yes,
there was an extraordinary event was triggered, which was the eruption of the volcano under what is now Santorini.
Uh-huh.
The Minoan civilization, it appears that the Minoans became ultimately the Minoan influence, that civilization ultimately manifested itself in the Phoenicians and the Carthaginians, which was the Punic Empire, and that they later had lots of influence over Greece. But Santorini and Minoan, the largest Minoan cities, which were on Crete,
right,
were all destroyed. A series of extraordinarily violent earthquakes,
mm-hmm.
A volcanic eruption, and a resulting tsunami that was probably in the range of 100 feet tall, moving at about 500 miles an hour. As a matter of fact, the Minoan cities that faced the direction that the tsunami went, and then with the last tsunami that occurred in Indonesia was a direct result of a 7.0, I think, earthquake. And in the ocean, of course, Santorini is an island. So in the ocean, when there is an earthquake, what happens is that when part of the surface of the floor of the ocean slips under, one plate slips under another, it creates a void. The water falls into that void, which then creates the wave-like action and sends it out in all directions. And in the coastal towns of the Minoan civilization, there isn't even a stone of everything that they built there. And this was the most advanced civilization by far in human history. In terms of a civilization beyond its time, they were 2,000 years beyond their, maybe 3,000 years behind their time. They were more advanced than the Greeks and the Romans were 500 to 1,500 years later.
Mm-hmm.
To put it in perspective. Anything
more. Systems and bathrooms and all kind of things.
Right.
It's quite amazing.
That's right. They had underground sewer systems for in-home toilets.
Right.
I mean, just extraordinary kinds of.
The first time I read that years
ago. Yeah.
I've
seen them. I've been there, but everything was pulverized. So we know, and the timing of that happens to be exactly the time, 1450-ish.
Mm-hmm.
BCE.
Yes.
This is the same time, and what is, in terms of human history, probably the single most catastrophic natural event in recorded human history. And when I say recorded human history, we have to be a little bit careful here in that that the victims of this were the entire Mediterranean region, but this predates the Greeks and the Romans. So it was the Minoans that were the primary, that was the lead civilization, and they were wiped out instantly. So there was no one to leave a record of it other than we can see the damage that was done. We can date the time.
Yeah.
So when you talk about an earthquake, this was the single greatest earthquake, volcanic eruption, which would have had atmospheric issues.
Certainly
and destructive plague of natural consequences in recorded history.
Yeah.
So when you talk about an earthquake, this is coterminous with this event.
Yeah. Well, the only question that really arose there from this perspective of reading the Torah and reading Apura was that in the translation. And we kind of resolved this way. In the translation, did the actual angel, the Malach, destroy every firstborn of every family in Egypt that didn't have the blood on the doorpost?
Mm-hmm.
And that's okay, because I'm not going to put Yahweh in a box and say you can't do it with a Malach.
Right.
Certainly. But when all the historians that from all this different evidence starts to come in where there's like a 90% in some cities wipe out of the population, you're going to destroy most of the people to begin with, and that certainly does. But we do know, if nothing else, we do know without any reservation that the Pharaoh's eldest son was thrown against the walls during the earthquake and killed. And well, it's symbolic of the whole first child of everything, and that gets into the. And so I went back and I translated that as best I could, but without the Dead Sea Scrolls, we left it at. We don't care how Yahweh did it. Whether it was earthquake totally, whether it was a Malach.
Yeah, and the difference here is the spelling of a word.
Yes.
Correct. And and whether it is based on Bakar, BKR. Which speaks of the of firstborn, and there's a number of places throughout the Torah, prophets, and Psalms that Yahweh references Pesach and references his actions regarding the firstborn, regarding Bakar, and that's the basis of Bakutim, is a firstborn child, and so as BKR, what he dealt with was the firstborn.
Right.
And then is, I think it's BCH, R, the CH being a single letter.
Yeah, or double H in the older term, but CH
yeah.
is now.
Yeah,
R
means finest.
Yeah, or yeah.
Choicest, most important.
Choice. Yeah, the choicest is probably.
Better. Yeah, choicest, finest, most important. And what you see is that with Egypt's pharaoh, the heir to Egypt's pharaoh,
right.
Egypt's most elite military forces, all of the Egypt's religious elite, which would have been in the temples, which crumbled,
right.
And political elite, which would have been in the palaces, which crumbled, and economic elite, which would have been in the largest homes, which crumbled. As well as because of the previous plagues, the animals, that their choicest was decimated.
Right.
And so both occurred.
Right. Well, we're really talking about the reliability of the Torah, and the Torah proves itself all the time. And what we can, you know, whether we don't have a Dead Sea Scrolls, anything earlier, to say whether it's this word or that word. But regardless, the devastation is terrible. Whether you cut off the head of the king or the child of the king, you know, you've sent one major signal, you know, that Yah was in charge, not him.
Yeah, and it was interesting, of course, that the Israelites would have been in either mud or papyrus kinds of structures. So as they were as this earthquake would have gone through, and the earthquake is certain at Pesach in this period of 1450 BCE, it would have and did destroy all of the lofty structures of the elite, political, religious, military elite, and so the choicest died.
Well, you can get killed by a brick, but my thinking is that the one thing that the Moloch seemed to do very, very well, Yahweh sends them to protect his family.
Mm-hmm.
He didn't protect the Egyptians, he didn't protect the Minoans, he didn't protect the Arabians, and on and on. But he does what he promised to do. He's going to protect his family.
You know,
so
you look at
the mark on the door of the Moloch, where I know for sure they're there protecting.
Give you another example. As they have dug now around Giza and around the pyramids, what they have found is cities of workers. The pyramids were not built by slaves, and the depictions of how they were built is really tremendously erroneous. It was just, you know, there was no difference between Egypt and what Saudi Arabia is now. It's personal fiefdom, and the people were kind of bribed with beer and bread to do, you know, things on behalf of the pharaoh. But their homes have been found. And their homes were all constructed of stone. An earthquake, the children would have been the most susceptible.
Sure. Oh, yeah.
Yeah. And but they were all constructed of stone. And yet in Goshen, they were constructed of papyrus and of mud brick,
yeah.
Which
and it probably didn't go up that high. You know, if you're in that kind of a hot climate, you probably want a small wall with some bamboo or some type of material.
Well, first of all, if you're a slave and you're living in a with mud walls. The ceiling isn't mud. The ceiling's not stone.
Yeah.
But if you're in an elite in those societies, they had mastered all sorts of ways to put in permanent kinds of ceilings, and the ceilings were such that if you were in them in an earthquake, you're going to die. You're going to be crushed.
Yeah.
But that was not the case with the children of Israel, and they were told to stay inside of their homes. Their homes were not at risk. They were not at risk inside of their homes.
So we pretty much, that was the end of the 10th plague, and what we found that, what we talked about was, of course, that the slaves, the Hebrews, left in a mass exodus, and they were allowed to leave. In fact, they were begged to leave. They gave them stuff, just as the story of Pearl recounts exactly the same thing that the Torah does. And the Exodus story is they gave them gold and they gave them silver and so forth. They gave them gold and a whole lot of other stuff.
Yeah, let's talk about that. Let's talk about that for a moment. But first, I just want to say there is no, in my view, discrepancy between whether it is BCHR or BKR. Firstborn or
chosen or choices
or first most important in importance is because one is a subset of the other. In societies throughout time, it's the firstborn that inherits the father's estates.
Right.
And so the firstborn that becomes king or pharaoh. And so they are the chosen one, the choicest.
Right.
And so one is a subset of the other. And so for there to be historic records now affirming that at this time, the choicest of Egypt were destroyed. Bukhurim is simply a subset of that. So if that is true, then Bukhurim is also true.
And the reason for the people that may be listening, the reason we're kind of picking at it is only because it's really important that we can trust and rely on what Yahweh said.
Yeah.
When he says something, it means in the vehicle he may use. And you realize that.
I think it's important. Okay. Well, most people are unaware that Yahweh proved his existence and he proved that he authored the Torah, prophets, and Psalms because he filled it with prophecy of events that he explained in great detail and committed to writing that were going to occur and have subsequently occurred exactly as he said they were, said they would. But you see, if you really understand prophecy, you recognize that prophecy isn't just a recording of future events. From a perspective of Yah, from the Hebrew language where time exists, there is no past, present, and future. From the existence of a spiritual being where time is, where God can report in our past what will occur in our future without predestining it, simply by witnessing and reporting back in prior to the time that it occurred because he exists in all time. Once you recognize that, you realize that history is part of prophecy. And so when God says, if you want to know if he inspired something, whether you can trust it, that it came from him, that you consider its bo and its haya, came to exist exists simultaneously, that means that you also ought to consider the validity of what he has reported occurred in our past, all the way from the creation account to the flood to this Exodus account. Test what he said. And if you find it to be true, as Kirk has done through this study,
absolutely,
then you are validating the authenticity of Yahweh's Torah.
Right.
And that you validate that it was inspired by a being who is completely accurate in his presentation of past, present, and future events, then you ought to pay attention to what he has to say and trust what he has to say.
Exactly. Well, there's really no argument the deeper you dig into these type of things. The one thing that may occur to someone, it certainly occurred to me, that if Yahweh got too heavily involved with Moloch,
right,
then it will start to lose our ability to have free will. If God stood up on the mountaintop and glowed like he will when he returns,
right?
Number one, you couldn't deal with it. But first of all, he doesn't want to coerce you into doing this.
Yeah. Well, Yahweh has, and certainly can, interact with individuals via a diminished manifestation of himself.
Yes,
he has. And he can, whenever he so chooses, to interact with humans, individual humans, through a diminished manifestation of himself, or through a collective group of humans through a diminished manifestation like fire and a pillar. He's done those things as well. For the most part, he his interaction with his children are via his word and via his set-apart spirit. But his, if he wishes to engage in human events, either to protect his children against those who are opposed to them and to him, or he wishes to get something done that really just needs to be accomplished to fulfill his ultimate agenda. Mm-hmm. He uses these implements, the malak.
Yes.
And there is absolutely no indication whatsoever that he is present with the malak when he uses them, with the exception of giving them instruction in the seventh dimension, in Shamayim, in heaven. There they are present with him, and he gives them instruction.
He gives them marching orders, right?
These are your orders, and they have no free will. They are orders. No. He gives them their instructions and tells them what he wants to do. And he has communicated to us many of those instructions. You know, the 91st Psalm is one of the great presentations of specific instructions that Yahweh has given to his malak relative to his children. But Yahweh, because he's seven-dimensional, can't easily and can never wholly engage in human affairs.
Mm-hmm.
So the malak is a means for him to do so. The malak is also a means, and this kind of gets you into interesting discussion about the nature of who Satan really is and how Satan operates, why Satan can actually go into to heaven. A malak can go into, for example, into Sodom.
Mm-hmm.
Yahweh can't go into Sodom. Yahweh can't be exposed. He's not going to allow that kind of evil in his presence. Yahweh can't go into Sodom, but the malak can. Malak did. Malak could go to Lot, Yah's covenant child in Sodom.
Mm-hmm.
So the malak can do things that Yahweh cannot and will not do. But Yahweh is not with the malak when they does the malak simply are a spiritual being that follows his orders. Which, by the way, it means they cannot love.
That's right.
But it also means that...
I don't view them with as many emotional things that most people do. In fact, I'll have to share with you what I covered when I looked up...
Can I just throw one thing about Satan? And,
sure.
And this is speculation on my part.
Okay.
But Satan is allowed into to heaven.
Okay.
Well, eventually, Satan is going to be banished to... And the fallen malak are going to be banished to the black hole, if you will, that is Sheol. But Satan is allowed into heaven, which means that Satan as a spiritual being, as a being comprised of light, is not being held accountable for being evil.
Right.
He is not looked at as sin.
And I can kind of prove it to you.
Okay, I think it's really interesting because I think I understand why Satan can enter heaven, because he has no accountability in the sense of the exercise of good judgment and personal responsibility and free will. His only reason for ultimately being banished is he was a tool, and the tool did not perform as requested. But you know, a hammer is.
A hammer
can be considered flawed and therefore not useful, but you would never consider a hammer evil. You know, if you were a perfect being, you are not going to say, you know, I'm not going to walk into a room with an ineffective hammer.
Mm-hmm.
Because you know, the hammer is not necessarily evil, but humans that are religious and political are diseased. They are evil.
Yes. Well, let me throw something out at
okay,
you.
Okay, go ahead.
We'll pick up all this other stuff, but
okay.
What I did, and thinking about what Roy had sent, and the term that I don't like too well is good and evil, because it's imbued with all the different
words and dictionaries of
what we think as an English-speaking language frame, number one.
Right.
So I went back to the Hebrew for evil, Ra.
Ra, and Tob, Tob
have,
for good.
In Ra, you have a translation, a simple translation would be dysfunctional. But it's impaired or abnormal action other than that which a person or thing is intended, something that does not function within its intended purpose, is the best definition I've found. Mm-hmm. Now, for tov, which is good, the definition becomes functional.
Functional, beneficial.
Yeah, now listen to this, because it's kind of cool. Fulfilling the action for which a person or a thing is specifically fitted or used, or for which a thing exists, something mm-hmm. that functions within its intended purpose.
Right.
Now, I hate to put this wrinkle on it, but if he invented Satan with the mm-hmm. capacity to be what he became, mm-hmm. he's still fulfilling his purpose because
Absolutely.
He became the adversary.
Yeah, and Yahweh makes it very clear that he created the adversary. He created
yes,
Satan.
He did.
He created that which was dysfunctional. Because
yes.
if he didn't, then this whole experiment would be a farce. It would be a waste of time.
Right.
There'd be no choice.
I don't see any reason to go into debate about, well, he's evil and God invented evil.
No, he's dysfunctional.
No, he invented a tool that can become
right.
dysfunctional.
He's dysfunctional. It's a tool that is being
dysfunctional. So don't imbue him with all
right.
these things.
Satan is not being punished.
English writers do about good and evil.
Right. Satan is not being punished. He's being discarded.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
As a matter of fact, even the people who are religious aren't being punished. They're being discarded.
Yeah.
They've chosen to be what they were not intended to be, so they're being discarded. And there isn't, for Satan, for example, for those humans that are discarded, there is a remedy for them. It's the Torah. But they've chosen to neglect that remedy. The Torah does not exist to fix a spiritual
it's
being.
Madness.
It does not exist to fix a spiritual being. So... Satan cannot be held accountable and cannot be judged by the conditions of the Torah, and he cannot be exonerated by, vindicated
yes.
by
right.
The benefits of the Torah. The Torah has no effect on him, where the Torah both condemns and vindicates humans who he could choose to either accept it or reject it.
Let me toss out one other thing to you.
Okay.
Associated with this, because people ask, I hate to think that why God doesn't is going. All these people that I know, these are good people, and they just mm-hmm. haven't found Yahweh
mm-hmm.
or whatever.
Right.
Yahusha said, "Everyone, if we believe the witness writings, Yahusha right. said, everyone's not good. Everyone's bad."
Mm-hmm. Right.
Why callest me thou good? I think it's the old King James Version.
Yeah, there's only one who's good.
So we start as people are not good. They're not perfect. They're not, and they just aren't.
By the way, now, this is the thing that I have found great satisfaction in.
Uh-huh.
To the degree that the Greek translation of what Yahusha said in Hebrew is accurate, then he would have said not that people aren't good. He would have said that they are low tob, that they lack the function for which they were designed,
right.
that they are deprived of the benefit. They're deprived of the benefit that was intended.
Right.
The people are not functional. Yeah, he's not making a moral judgment in the sense of good or bad. But of appropriateness, of functionality, of capitalizing and of capitalizing on the intended purpose.
Right.
You know, we were intended to be sons and daughters of our Creator. We were intended to be smart, to be able to be judgmental, to love that which is beneficial and to despise that which is harmful. We were created to function as God's children. And spend an eternity with him. That's how we were created and designed. And so he's saying, no, most people don't function that way.
No.
They're dysfunctional.
That explains dode. It explains what your job
exactly.
is to do to get back to that relationship is to get on the path, which brings us right back to Passover. That's what saved the Egyptians. That's what will save you. I mean, the ones that were in Egypt, the Hebrews that were in Egypt.
That's right.
Get on the path. He didn't ask you to be good.
No, nor did he ask you to be perfect.
And he don't like evil. He don't like bad, but he wants you to be functional. Here's the one thing that you can function, thing you can do correct.
That is brilliant. That is, Pesach is the doorway to functionality.